Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit, nonpartisan forum open to the public. I'm Gloria Duffy, President and CEO of the club. To learn more about events or membership, join us online at commonwealthclub.org.
Good evening. Dr. Adam Ghazali was born and raised in New York City. He obtained an MD and a PhD degree in neuroscience at the Mount Sinai School of Medicine in New York. His doctoral research focused on receptor plasticity in the hippocampus and normal aging. This research earned him the prestigious 1997 Cortical Scholar Award. He then completed a clinical residency in neurology at the University of Pennsylvania. Following residency, he traveled to UC Berkeley for a cognitive neuroscience fellowship and a clinical fellowship in cognitive neurology at UCSF Memory and Aging Center. Dr. Ghazali is currently director of the Neuroscience Imaging Center at the University of California, San Francisco, a faculty member in neurology, physiology, and psychiatry departments, and principal investigator of a neuroscience laboratory that conducts research on the neural mechanisms of attention and memory. A major focus of his research has been to expand our understanding of the alterations in the aging brain that lead to cognitive decline. His most recent studies explore how we can improve attention and memory abilities in older adults. He has authored over 40 scientific studies, and his research has been profiled in high-impact media such as the Wall Street Journal, Time Magazine, Discover, PBS, NPR, NBC Nightly News, and The Today Show. He has received awards and honors for his research, including the Pfizer AFAR Innovations in Aging Award and the Ellison Foundation New Scholar Award in Aging. So welcome and thank you for being here, Dr. Ghazali.
I'll stand behind a podium today. All right, I want to thank you all for coming. It's an honor to speak here at the Commonwealth Club, and thank you, Patty and Bill, for inviting me today. This is a new talk for me to give to an audience, so I'm excited about it. I've been working on it for quite some time now, and hopefully you enjoy it. The title, it's slightly changed after I actually created the talk, to Our Brain's Perspective on Distraction and Multitasking in the Modern Media World. Let me not be distracted and find my remote. Okay, so let me introduce you to the two stars of today's talk. The first is the brain. And this is a topic that's dear to my heart. I think I finally qualify as being an expert on this after 20 years of research and clinical experience. And then that sets it in contrast to the other star of today's talk, which is A Wonderful World of Modern Media, which I am not an expert at in terms of research or clinical experience, but I assure you on a practical level, I have a lot of expertise level experience in dealing with multimedia on a daily basis. So the thesis of today's talk is that there's an explosion in the variety and accessibility of e-media coupled with new expectations for immediate responsiveness. And this is causing increased interference in our brains, resulting in an impact on our cognition and performance. So to outline this, I'm going to start by introducing you to this media in the modern world and tell you what I mean by that. Then we're going to talk about the brain and take a tour through several aspects of it. I'm going to tell you about its limitations, tell you about this concept of cognitive control, tell you about interference and essentially in two areas, distraction and multitasking, and I'll tell you what I mean by that. Then we're going to move on and explore the consequences of what I'm referring to as a media-brain interaction. And then lastly, we're going to talk about what we can do about all this. Okay, so let's begin. Media are the tools that store and deliver information. And the last 10 years has resulted in a proliferation, a dramatic proliferation in the amount of media, its diversity and its accessibility, which has really shifted the landscape of the media world. You can see here the tremendous variety that I'm sure you're all familiar with. This is coupled by an equally present amount of devices that deliver this media. What's most interesting, however, is not just the amount of media, it is the way that we use media. So I think that we're all aware that there's essentially an obsessive media multitasking frenzy going on, where we all entertain in multiple forms of media. So let me make this a little bit more personal. Has anyone in this room ever worked on a document, listened to music, and checked their email? Let me see some hands so I could get an idea. So that I figured that would be pretty common. How about this one? Have you ever been watching television with your laptop open, searching the internet, and responding to texts? Okay, pretty common. And we could probably couple many, many more of these. Recent reports show that approximately 95% of people report multitasking during the day, and that it pretty much consumes almost a third of a person's day in concurrently engaging in these multiple forms of media. Here's some interesting quotes from a report that just came out by the Kaiser Foundation that did a report on this in children. So this was, I found interesting. This person says, "I multitask every single second I am online. At this very moment, I am watching TV, checking my email every 2 minutes, reading a news group about who shot JFK, burning some music to a CD, and writing this message." And this young woman wrote, "I'm always talking to people through instant messaging, and then I'll be checking email or doing homework or playing games and talking on the phone at the same time." So we have this incredible amount of media multitasking that is going on, and there's more and more reports about this coming out all the time. But in addition to the amount of media and the way we're using media, another thing that's evident is that there's a change in our expectations. So given the constant access to communications, to computers and data, it's really changed societal expectations. So now there's almost this need for immediate responsiveness and continuous productivity. And this is becoming expected. You can't just be off on a vacation anymore because people know you have your email sitting in your pocket. I'm sure everyone recognizes this aspect. So these two events, the explosion in media and the diversity, as well as the shifting expectations, has really created this interesting balance in what occurs in our brain. So now I'm going to talk about the brain. And I could spend hours and days telling you about how wonderful I think the brain is. It's the most complex substance we know in the universe. It mediates all of our interactions with the world around us. But for the purpose of this talk, I'm going to actually talk about several of its limitations. The first, I'm going to tell you about our limitations in attentional resources. Second, I'm going to tell you about limitations in storage capacity, limitations in processing speed, and limitations in sensitivity to interference. So let's just go quickly through these things because it'll relate to our discussion about how it interacts with media. So we know from our experience that we don't have infinite attentional resources, that we essentially use, and this term and analogy has been used quite frequently in the psychology literature, we use a searchlight of attention to limit our perception to information that is relevant to our goals. This doesn't have to be just for visual information. One of the most classic descriptions is known as the cocktail party effect. I'm sure everyone's experienced this. What's going on here is this woman is really not interested in what her date has to say, and you could see by the things going on inside her head that she's really listening to what this gentleman has to say about a new gallery open. So even though she's standing closest to this person, her attention is directed elsewhere, and that's what she's listening to. So this attention is like a spotlight. You move it around, but it doesn't have infinite breadth. It has to be focused in order for you to take in information. So this is a limitation, one that we're all aware of. Another limitation is in capacity, essentially in the storage of information. And this is most obvious when we talk about this concept of working memory. What working memory is, it's the ability to maintain and manipulate information that is no longer accessible in the environment for a brief period of time in order to guide subsequent behavior. The most frequent example of this is if someone gives you a phone number and you hold it in your mind until you get on the phone. Now, it's probably different. You probably could just electronically transfer it. But certainly that is a classic example of working memory. There's this rather famous paper by George Miller in 1956 where he says that the number 7 is sort of the limit for digits plus or minus 2. And there's an urban legend that this is the reason that phone numbers are 7 digits long. The reality is that as we've now over the years looked at more and more examples of working memory and its capacity, we see that it changes depending on the complexity of the information that you're holding in mind. So for digits, it might be 7, for letters 6, for words 5, 3 or 4 for objects, and maybe 2 or even 1 to hold a face in mind. So this is a serious limitation on how we interact with the world. The information that we hold for very short periods of time is actually very limited. Let's talk about speed limitations. The brain is very fast at processing. Information is processed on the order of milliseconds within a brain region. The limitation comes in is that our brain does not work as these isolated regions. The brain functions as a network. And so processing speed is limited by these complex interactions between distant brain areas. So because all these communications have to go on, this is where you can accumulate slowness of processing when you're doing very complicated operations. And then sensitivity to interference. The brain has been shown to be exquisitely sensitive to certain types of interference. I recently documented a conceptual framework to put all the different types of interference into a structure that interfere with our cognition. So the way I frame this is that there's both internal and external interference. I'm going to just focus on external for first. One type is distractions. Irrelevant information. This is the type of interference that occurs. Let's say you're at a restaurant, you're trying to have a conversation, the waiter's taking an order at the next table, you're trying to shut it out. It's a distraction. It's irrelevant. You want to ignore it. The other type is what I call interruptions, multitasking. You choose to pay attention to something else because you're interrupted by it. So, for instance, you're on the way to the refrigerator to get something to eat, and the phone rings. You pick it up, you have a conversation. Now you have to reactivate what you were going to do. So it's another type of interference. This can easily happen internally as well. Mind wandering, intrusions, irrelevant information that just pops into your head, and what I refer to as diversions, another type of multitasking. You remember you left something on the stove, and now what you were engaged in has become a secondary task, and you move to something else. So you can see that this world of interference, which is a big subject of my research, is a very complex, intricate way of causing interference in cognitive processes. So I think you see the issue now, right? Let's just make it really clear. We have multimedia and the increasing variety and accessibility, as well as the shifting expectations of how we're supposed to use that media. Then we have the brain with limitations in processing speeds, as well as limitations in capacity, as well as sensitivity to interference. So it makes you want to ask the question, how do we function at all? Right? We have this incredible amount of interfering sources, and we have a brain that's sensitive to it and has all these limitations. The way we function is through a process of cognitive control. So what cognitive control is, and I'm going to summarize it in this slide, is how we perceive the world around us is not a passive process. The world just doesn't flood into your brain without your control. You're not a slave to how you perceive things. It's influenced by attention. And really, two types of attention sculpt and shape how you perceive the world. The first is external, stimulus-driven attention. So if there's a loud sound or a flash of light, you pay attention even if you didn't want to. The world sort of drives your attention. That's also known as bottom-up attention, attention that's demanded by the environment around you. The other type is what you're doing now, internal goal-directed attention. You're choosing to focus your resources, your cognitive resources on what I'm saying, on the slides, and therefore you're able to perceive it differently. This is also known as top-down attention, sort of coming from the top of the hierarchy. What we study in our lab is how these two types of attention go on and influence how you remember things over the short and the long term. So this is cognitive control. Cognitive control is your ability to use your goals to direct your attention to overcome other sources of attention that might be being driven by the environment. So let's go and show you an example of how this occurs and how it can fail. So let's look at the scenario here and focus your attention on this gentleman here. You could say that he should be engaged, his top-down resources should be engaged in focusing on this group of people over here. He's involved in this conversation. If he has any chances of remembering the details of it, he would be paying attention to this. But there's some sort of bottom-up source, something from the environment that has commanded his attention. Maybe it's an altercation of some sort, and it's strong enough that it's attracted the attention of three other people in the room. However, notice this. This woman over here has enough top-down resources that even though she's closest to it, she's so engaged in her text message that she's able to ignore this, right? So you ask yourself the question, is this successful attention and successful and failed attention? Or is this successful ignoring and failed ignoring? And what we realize is that there's really two faces of attention. There is focus, and there's also ignore. And what a lot of research from our lab over the last 7 years has shown is that these are not two sides of the same coin, but they're dissociable. In other words, you can be fine at paying attention and focusing, Where you're failing is ignoring. And we have a lot of data that I'm not going to talk about today showing that older adults have a selective problem in ignoring things that are irrelevant. Although they pay attention as if they were 20 years old, they focus on what's relevant. It's really the ignoring that fails. So it's a little bit of an aside, but you'll see that it relates to what we're going to talk about today. Okay, what happens in the brain? How does this look? So I just gave you a conceptual sort of psychological description of what cognitive control is. Here's an example of how it works for the visual system. Here's your brain. This is the front of your brain, the back of your brain. When you process visual things in the world, you use the occipital lobe, which is this back portion of your brain over here, and the temporal lobe, this portion over here. What we think happens is that the prefrontal cortex, the front part of your brain, then sends signals to these visual areas and modulates the activity based on your goals. If something is relevant, the activity is boosted up. If something is irrelevant, you suppress it. And we call this process top-down modulation. It's how you sort of sculpt and modulate how you process things in the world based on your goals. Okay, so that's the view from the brain. Now, the prefrontal cortex is an interesting area of the brain. For a long period of time, scientists were very unsure what it did. We knew that it was involved in motor control when you go further back to the motor area, which borders on the prefrontal cortex. But there were many studies that show when you lesion these areas in animals, there was no clear sign of what the damage was. This was not helped very much at first by this very other interesting case of Phineas Gage. Is everyone familiar with the story of Phineas Gage? All right, so let's talk about it a little bit. So on September 13th, 1848, the 25-year-old Phineas Gage, who was a railroad foreman in Vermont, was working on the railroad tracks, and he had the job of, after the hole was put in where the dynamite was going to be, he places the powder, fills it up with sand, uses a tamping iron, which is these rather large metal irons, 3 feet 7 inches long, 13 pounds, and he tamps in the sand so that the charge is set and puts a wick in there. According to some of the reports I read, he was distracted, which is sort of ironic given the nature of the talk and what happens to him. And then there's an unfortunate spark, which is sort of an understatement, driving this tamping iron, penetrating below his left eye, through the top of his skull. The rod landed 60 feet behind him. Here's some images of what it looked like. It's pretty dramatic. Entirely destroying the front part of his brain. By most reports, Phineas didn't even lose consciousness. He went to the hospital, and he was patched up and seemed to be okay, further leading to evidence that the prefrontal cortex doesn't do very much. But what happened afterward was that it was realized that he was no longer Phineas Gage. And this is a report by his doctor, Harlow, at the time. He says that he was fitful, irreverent, indulging at times in the grossest profanity. This was someone that was a very conservative person prior to this. He was impatient of restraint or advice when it conflicted with his desires. He was obstinate, devising many plans of operation, which are no sooner arranged than they are abandoned in turn for others that appear more feasible. And then he had this interesting observation. He said that the balance between his intellectual faculties and his animal propensities seems to have been destroyed. If we look at the prefrontal cortex, you could see that it is the part of our brain that has evolved the most. If you started cats and squirrel monkeys, we didn't even go further back, you could see the blue over here is the prefrontal cortex. Even in chimps compared to humans, there's been a lot of development. This is the part of our brain that's involved in cognitive control. What happened to Phineas is that basically he lost control. He was unable to control his behaviors in the normal, appropriate way that we do, and unable to behave in that manner, and also control other aspects, and I'm going to talk a little bit about that. Another interesting thing about the prefrontal cortex is just not that it's the last part to have evolved, but it's also the last part to develop. So if you follow the development of the brain, and what you're looking at here are markers of gray matter density. Actually, the brain starts with a larger density and then shrinks. So the blue over here is signifying mature cortex. These are 5-year-olds, these are 20-year-olds, and you can see that the last part of the brain to become developed is the prefrontal cortex. This is very evident. So if we look at the role throughout evolution and development, and you think about children, you see that they have poor top-down control. They're driven by the environment. They have a goal, and then you show them something else, and they have a whole new goal, right? And animals are this way too, right? If you think about a dog or a cat, they're very sensitive to environmental stimuli. Their ability to set goals and carry them out are pretty low to non-existent, right? So the prefrontal cortex is quite sensitive to our ability to control how we act in the world. So now let's talk about how this relates to interference. I'm going to tell you about an experiment that we did in our lab looking at the mechanism of interference on memory. I'm going to focus on connections between brain areas, not structural connections, but functional connections, how brain areas communicate with each other to guide behavior, sort of what we call in our business neural networks. So the prefrontal cortex, as I said, communicates with other areas, let's say visual areas in this case. And I'm going to focus on external interference. This experiment was designed to see the differences and similarities between dealing with distractions and dealing with interruptions, multitasking, which I sort of put in the category of both two types of interference. So this experiment was conducted in my lab at UCSF, and it uses a device called functional MRI. Has everyone been in an MRI scanner here? Or a lot of people have? Okay, this is a little different. It's not any different in terms of the physics of the machine. It's still an MRI machine. But what we can do is that we measure a different signal. We call it the BOLD signal, blood oxygen level dependent signal. And what it does is it looks for very subtle changes in blood flow in the brain, and these changes correlate with changes in neural activity. So because we have this very nice signal, what we can do is have people lay in the scanner, and instead of just lying there in darkness, we can show them images. They could look through a mirror on a projector over here, and we could present experiments, essentially like video games, while we're scanning their brain looking at activity. So pretty much in real time, we can look at what's occurring in changes in the brain as they perform a task, a memory or an attention task. And here's our scan over here. There's a graduate student in my lab doing an experiment that looks at changes in memory and attention. Right. So the connection is lost, and it has to reactivate right before you have to make the decision. So you can see here that it's not that you're holding that face in mind. You're sort of letting it go. We could see, I'm not going to show you this data, but we have a paper that we're working on right now that show that older adults look exactly the same, except they don't reactivate very well. So, you know, you can imagine trying to hold something in mind that you're off to, you know, get something to drink out of the refrigerator, the phone call comes up, and you're like, what was I doing? I mean, everyone's had this experience, and it seems that this reactivation is necessary. So what does this tell us about distraction and interference? Well, first it tells us that the front of the brain is like a bouncer, and this sort of analogy has been made before. It determines exactly what information is on the guest list, what is going to pass in, and it establishes that by connecting with visual areas. You might think of the visual areas sort of as a nightclub, one with a lot less people than you picture here. I couldn't find one with only four or five, but really that's what it comes down to. If you cannot restrict this area to only the relevant information, if this bond is not strong, if other information comes in, you have interference and you don't remember what is relevant as well. So what we could see here is that the cost of failing to do this is an impact on performance. And we've been publishing several papers over the years showing that this is true for older adults, but it's even true for younger adults. So this paper that we just had come out this year shows that the main influence on performance in our experiment on the younger adults was not how well they were focusing. They were sort of focusing continuously fairly well, but what was fluctuating was their levels of ignoring, and that was influencing their performance. All right, so now let's turn to multitasking. Again, the prefrontal cortex is involved, but here the prefrontal cortex is acting as a flight controller. It's determining exactly what is the priority right now. So it might determine to focus its attention, let's say in this scenario, on traffic. Seems like a good thing to focus on. Someone might make the rather foolish decision that maybe the attention should be focused on the text message. I don't know if you could see this picture here, but it's a messenger bike up texting while driving in traffic in New York. And so one thing that we learn is that this doesn't happen. Both don't happen at the same time, that there's a bottleneck in the prefrontal cortex. The prefrontal cortex does not engage in multiple complicated streams of information at the same time. It's led to what has almost become known as the myth of multitasking. What's essentially happening is that the prefrontal cortex is switching between these two goals very rapidly, hopefully rapidly, the more rapidly the better. This has a cost. It has a cost on the time delay to switch, and also because of that switching, there's a decreased quality of task performance. Okay? So I think we've done a sort of good job now of showing you that how the brain works, how media works, and how distraction and multitasking might fit in. But let's really go through the consequences right now. One thing I want to say before moving on to that is that this is not a problem that's going to go away. We seem to be very invested in coming up with creative forms of interference. I don't know if anyone has this iPhone app that lets you use the camera on the back of your iPhone while you walk. So here's someone walking their dog that lets you do emails while you're walking along. I don't know if anyone actually uses this, but just the fact that it exists is really a statement to how we really want to actively multitask. I know of many examples. I have friends in this audience who are expert multitaskers and probably want to go get this app after I finish talking today. Okay, so we've talked about, we've given you the background, and now let's face, what are the consequences? What are the consequences of this explosion in media, and especially multitasking of media, and our brain? Positive influences. This was actually not an easy slide to make. I usually try to only put up slides that I have references for. I'm now going to give you a list of things that are really based on anecdotal evidence, the people's impressions, including some of my impressions. It was very hard. I was not successful. If anyone could find it, please email me and let me know some evidence of positive advantages of multitasking. Here are some things that people have said and that I think are probably true to some degree and probably could be shown, that multitasking offers a level of flexibility. It allows you to direct attention to the task that you feel best able to make progress on at that moment. Right? So you're not stuck in one thing that might not be going well. It gives you a fresh perspective when returning to a task. It's often helpful to step away and come back to something. It gives you increased variety that makes our lives feel more well-rounded and richer in experience. So just feel more productive, especially enables productivity in downtime. Some of the reports I read of children that multitask is just fascinating little descriptions is, you know, that short download time when you're trying to download like an attachment is just not long enough to sit there and wait. You know, you got a good 5 seconds, you might as well start doing something else. So I don't think that is probably a good example, but there's certainly times when there are periods that it might be worthwhile to switch. Another one is that it just seems more fun. I think so, too. I enjoy multitasking. It seems like a challenge, and it would make sense from a brain perspective. Our brains are very responsive to novelty. The dopamine system is exquisitely sensitive to things that are new, and moving around and switching must have that type of feedback. And I think, you know, although there's not data on this is speculation, but I think that the act of multitasking probably has a little bit of an addictive quality to it in terms of its reward of constantly moving on to more novel things. So I think that's an interesting experiment that I'm sure someone will do eventually. But there certainly seems to be a strong drive to do it, right? I mean, it is very common, and I think this has a lot to do with it. There's a little bit more data for the benefits of distraction, surprisingly enough. There's some data from a colleague of mine that shows that susceptibility to distraction may sometimes facilitate performance on a later task. So if you take in more information than you should, including things that are irrelevant, it may impact your performance on the task you're doing, and we've shown tons of evidence that that's true, but you will remember that information better than someone that actually ignored it. And if in the future you need that information, you will have it. So there is some evidence to suggest that maybe you have a larger scope, a larger general perspective of things in the world if you're more distractible. Personally, I don't feel that that's a good enough reason to be distractible, but it can be perceived as a benefit. Another is that background noise, which is normally distracting, can actually reduce the negative impact of office noise. So there's a lot of experiments and a lot of implementation of this in the working environment where continuous noise is put into the working space to help decrease the distraction of office noise, which might be more interfering. And that's been shown to occur. Interesting, if you read through this study, it actually shows that that this background noise that's inserted in does help performance, but not beyond what it would have in silence. Silence is still the best. But people don't really like it, right? So subjectively, it's much less pleasant than silence. If you compare this to music put in the office space, subjectively, that is considered more pleasant, but it doesn't help. It doesn't show that it helps reduce the impact of the office noise beyond the levels that it's at. So it's sort of an interesting way of looking at distraction as something that can be helped, causing interference between different types of distraction. Then there is another very interesting finding, is that there is one form of media that has been shown to actually have a positive influence on distractibility. Does anyone know what this is? Video games. So despite all the bad press that video games had for a long time, and there certainly is some negative evidence, there's accumulating at a rapid rate evidence that video games can be quite beneficial. So action video games in particular have been shown, this is a paper by Green and Bevelaire in Nature in 2003, showing that action video games improve attentional and perceptual abilities, specifically resistance to distraction, breath, and the capacity of attention. It's a rather nice paper. There's been a couple follow-up papers showing other aspects of attention that are improved. This was an experiment that compared video game players to non-video game players. So you could make the case, well, maybe people that play video games have better attention abilities, and that's why they play them. They find it more enjoyable. So then they did another experiment where they compared 10 hours of gameplay on an action video game. They used Medal of Honor, and they compared it to a game that also used a lot of motor coordination but didn't have the same demands on multitasking and attention. They used Tetris. And what they found, sure enough, that Medal of Honor improved all these measures and Tetris did not. So there's some interesting data on these influences that could possibly be channeled to greater benefits. Negative influences. So this is where there was lots of data, right? So the data, we could start with just really interesting descriptions from the 1700s. This is a description by Samuel Johnson, and he said that the true art of memory is the art of attention. He said that no man will read with much advantage who is not able at pleasure to evacuate his mind. That if the repositories of thought are already full, what can they receive? And if the mind is employed on the past or the future, the book will be held before the eyes in vain. And these were really insightful comments. This was way before the time that we started investigating how attention and memory interact with each other. And I think that it really says a lot about what we're now understanding from our research. This is another one that's quite interesting by Lord Chesterfield in a letter to his son in the 1740s. And what he said is that there is enough time for everything in the course of the day if you do but one thing at once. But there is not time enough in the year if you will do two things at a time. And it's an interesting, he was very, very anti-multitasking, as you can see. There were dozens of quotes that I could pick from that shows this really strong opinion, which is interesting because I think multitasking usually gets a very beneficial way of looking at it and that it is going to help productivity. But his insight was that that was the wrong logic. And now I'm going to show you lots of evidence of why that is the wrong logic other than intuition. So I'm going to talk about two main genres, safety, as you could see the text message walking across the road, and cognition, the ability, the feeling that we could forget things when we have interference in our lives. So let's start with the impact on safety. Let's do the most obvious one and just get it out of the way first, right? So there's a lot of press about this now. Is everyone aware about all the press? Does everyone know it's illegal in California? Right, so the first law in July got rid of cell phones while driving, which obviously has a big impact. And then in January, there was a law placed that it's illegal to text while drive. And frankly, I mean, I think it's clearly pretty dangerous. It's beyond just multitasking and competing for resources because you actually have to look away from the road to text. So this is a clear example of how multitasking can impair safety. There's lots of others. I'm certainly not going to go through many of them. There's one interesting one. Has everyone read this story? On October 29th, 2009, a Northwest Airlines jet with more than 140 people on board lost contact for more than an hour before it landed in Minneapolis. It had overshot its destination by 150 miles. Does everyone know this story? Do you know why this occurred? It occurred because of laptopping while flying. So apparently the two pilots got a new scheduling program. As you know, the Delta Northwest was absorbed into Delta, and there was a lot of work to do to learn this, and they pulled out their laptops, and they lost track. They basically were distracted by this new task, and now there's all these laws that go into effect about laptoping while flying and things of that nature. But the point is that it's clearly a way that it impacts safety. Let's talk about other aspects. How does it impact education and memory? I'm just going to touch on a couple of these things. So there was an interesting study that just came out in 2007 that showed that the amount of time that young adults, these were college students, spent IMing, was significantly related to higher rates of distractibility on academic tasks. And the paper looked fairly good. I read through it yesterday. Notably in reading books. And it seems that there's three reasons this could be occurring. One, that IMing actually replaces reading books because it just pushes it out because so much of time is spent doing it. The other is that they occur at the same time and they limit the reading of books and the quality of reading books because of the switching. And then the third, which is the most interesting, which there's other evidence that shows that it might be true, is that there is a change in the cognitive patterns that people conduct their lives with because of this constant need to switch between media. And that this leads to the inability to focus attention for long, continuous times on one activity, like reading a book. So this is certainly a big concern. And if that is the reason, and there have to be studies to follow that up, that would be way more concerning than it just replacing it because of pushing out because of time reasons. Here are some others related to distraction. There's a rather nice study showing that background television during reading actually impairs memory recall. During the act of reading, you test later, and there's some evidence of that. There seems to be some sense in the literature that it depends on where it occurs. This study seemed to do a good job at having television during recall and during encoding of information. And the same applies to background music, at least by this study. And the point is that it does seem to be some impact of distraction on these abilities. The music one is interesting in that sometimes it can have a facilitatory effect, as we mentioned before, if it's in the context of other types of distraction. Let's talk a little bit about development. This is a controversial issue. There are some, I was just reading, this is not my area of expertise, I focus on the other end of the lifespan, but I was just reading this rather heated debate that this article raised after it was published, but I will show you what it is. They found that greater amounts of television viewed by children when they were 1 and 3 years old was associated with attentional problems at age 7. And these are the same type of tests that they used to diagnose ADHD, although these children did not go through this diagnosis. And this was pretty significant effect. It makes you ask the question of why wouldn't they sell infant video games if they're dangerous, right? That's the question. And what we know is that video games have been sold as educational tools to give your baby a head start, right? So is everyone aware that this happened just last month? So the Walt Disney Company is offering a full refund to people who purchased Baby Einstein DVD between June 5th, 2004, which was actually 1 month after this paper came out. I don't know if they're related to each other, but that I went back and took a look, and September 4th, 2009. No receipt is required, and the offer is valid until March 2010. So this is a very unprecedented move. And as far as I could find, the Walt Disney Company did not offer any statement saying that they thought this was dangerous. They just decided to avoid a potential lawsuit, which seemed to be creeping up, and just basically refund all the money. So it's quite interesting to think that media can have this impact on things like distractibility and attention later in life. And I think that the argument was at what stage this occurs, that this might not happen if it was five-year-olds doing it. But it's still interesting. You know, going back to our discussion about how the prefrontal cortex is the last part of your brain to develop, this area is very formative during these years, and the right type of environment is important for development of this region. Okay, impact on work. I found this rather nice study with the PI Gloria Mack at UC Irvine, and she did these very interesting observational studies. This is focused on IT workers. And what she found through this observation was that people engage in a project for around 12 minutes, right? So they encapsulate a project through all these type of criteria where you're working on one type of device, on one compartmentalized, focused goal. And then 12 minutes later, you're on to a new project. This is often because of an interruption, sometimes external, but sometimes just internally, switch. And then around 12 minutes later, you often return to this project. So it's around a 25-minute interruption on each project. But there's around 10 of these that you fluctuate in throughout the course of the day, or at least these workers did. But the most interesting part of the study was not that 12-minute period of time of the project, was that each of these 12-minute periods are interrupted every 3 minutes by an interruption, email, internet, and phone being the most common. So you have all of these multiple events that occur throughout the day, and this author from the New York Times made a very interesting analogy comparing this to almost skipping a stone across water, that this is what our attention is like in the modern day office, that it's not very deep and it just touches down at multiple points and keeps moving along. And now there's lots of studies that are following up to look at what is the impact of this in productivity. Some studies have suggested that the impact, the financial impact of this type of behavior is in the billions. So I have not seen many contradictory papers to the impact, the negative impact that this has on work. Okay, what about, this is, I think, one of the most fascinating studies. This was a colleague and a friend of mine, Anthony Wagner, who's at Stanford, and he has a very similar lab to my own cognitive neuroscience lab. And he did this study on the impact of media multitasking on distractibility itself. So what he did was he put out a questionnaire, and they recruited groups of individuals that were heavy media multitaskers and light media multitaskers. They actually had a whole questionnaire, and then they divided people up and took people that were at the extremes, and they had a whole set of criteria and what that meant to media multitask. And then they gave them a series of cognitive control tasks. And what they found was that heavy multitaskers were more susceptible to interference from irrelevant information, they were more distractible, and less effective at task switching. Which is amazing because these are the skills you need to multitask, right? So it raises the question, there's no causality here, it's correlational. It raises the question, does the act of multitasking all the time make you more distractible and less able to focus on one thing? Or maybe people that are more distractible and less able to focus on one thing are the same people that wind up multitasking. Here's some data from it. All the subjects had to do here was remember the direction of the two red bars, the orientation, hold it in mind for 1 second, and then say whether or not it matched. And the blue bars are distractors. And what they look at all these time points is that they increase the number of distractors, the number of blue bars. And you can see the light media, these are the dashed ones, the light media multitaskers, really aren't affected by these bars. But the heavy media multitaskers, you can see they take this plunge in performance as they go up to 4 or 6 blue bars. They're distracted by it. It's affecting their performance to remember the orientation of the red bars. All right, so what can be done? That was a pretty dismal picture, right? So what can we do about this? Well, it seems to me that there's two directions you can travel in. One, we can change our behavior. And the second, we could change our brain, right? I'll just give you a second to get over that horrible picture that I just put up. Okay, changing behavior. So there's several ways we can do this. We can have laws that make us change our behavior, like no driving while texting, no laptoping while flying, right? So we could control behavior through that, and it's shown to be pretty effective, right, in terms of sort of cell phone use while driving has dramatically decreased. We can evolve new technology to control it. So there's this technology called EVA, Electronic Virtual Assistant. Does everyone know about this? What it does is it basically converts your voice into a text and reads your text for you. So it allows you to continue to text little short messages, but through that same format, but to do it in a much safer way. So it's just an example of how technology can evolve along with the impact to try to give people benefit. And then we can establish personal rules of conduct of how we engage and use media. And I'm going to tell you a little about that on the next slide. Or we could change our brain. The two ways that I think we can most effectively change our brain is through medication or through training. Right? So medication, there's lots of meds out there that are deemed cognitive enhancers. For instance, the medications that we use to treat Alzheimer's disease, the cholinesterase inhibitors, were called cognitive enhancers when they were first marketed. And although none of these work quite that well in people that are already cognitively intact. They really work much better in people that have impairment to start with. There is the potential that we will learn how to develop pharmacological interventions that make us smarter and better able to deal with this interference. So I'm not passing any value judgment. I'm just telling you what's in the list of options. And the other is to train our brains. And I'm going to tell you about these two just in a little bit more detail. So changing our behavior. Well, now that we've spent the last hour talking about some of the pros and cons, we can use that information to guide decisions we make on how we conduct our lives and our days, especially in the context of dealing with media. So here's two possibilities that I've been trying to change my behavior with. So we could say that important tasks that demand high quality should be given singular attention. You should quit your email program. You should turn your phone to airplane mode. You should close your door. You should focus get the task done, right? I tried to do that when I made these slides over the last couple of days to some degree of success. But prolonged, boring tasks might be the better ones to use for multitasking, where they might actually get some benefit of the little bursts of arousal of switching to something more interesting, especially if they don't demand the type of quality that this other task did. So I'm not telling you all to go out and do this, but I'm saying that we do not have to just follow blindly and use the media in a way that seems reflexive, that you can actually make decisions on based on data and what we understand on how it can impact cognition and performance to guide our behavior in a more optimal way. Or we could change our brains, right? So cognitive training, there's actually a good amount of information that you can get better at both multitasking and dealing with distraction through practice. So there's a whole series of papers here that training on dual tasks, doing two things at the same time, listening to something and making a visual decision, can actually improve over short periods of time. We have a paper showing that it can improve even over the course of a single hour. The mechanism of this just came out in a beautiful paper in Neuron in 2009, just last month, that shows that the way you get better at multitasking is that you don't distribute it to another region, right? So one option was that another region could pick up the other job. Another option is that same region could start doing two streams at the same time. What seems to happen is that the same region, the prefrontal cortex, just does the switching faster. It processes the information faster. At least that's the conclusion of this paper. And then therefore, the events finish at closer time to each other. And distraction, that practicing on tasks with distracting information leads to improvement in filtering. We have some data for this. There's yet, as I know, no clear mechanism by which this occurs, but it's something that we're looking into in our lab. All right, our last slide. I wanted to give you a little glimpse of what we're doing in our own lab to help with this. So we have been studying distraction and interference, and we decided to use the advantages of that one media that has been shown to have some benefit, video games, and design a video game specifically to improve abilities to resist distraction and engage in more effective multitasking. So the game, we call it DWD, Driving While Distracted. It's a car game, a car driving game. We designed it in collaboration with LucasArts and colleagues at that video game design company, and here's what it looks like. You're driving along. These signs, it's actually very hard to navigate on the road. These signs come up. A lot of times the signs are entirely irrelevant. Sometimes you have to make selective decisions, like only respond to the green circle, ignore the other signs, like that sign over there. And there's two folks from my lab here, Jacqueline and Jean, who've been working on this project. Is anyone else here that I didn't? No, okay. So this game over here is designed to improve these abilities as you practice. But what makes this game really interesting in this experiment is that it's designed to be played while we record brain activity. So we can have someone come in, and this is an experiment that's now funded by the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation. We have participants come in. This is focused on older adults. They come in, and we can record brain activity with EEG. We're also going to probably do this with fMRI. And then they go through a period of training at home. We now have a collaboration with Apple, and they're supplying 40 laptops for us to do this training at home. So they play the game, we record their performance over time, and then they come back into the lab and we record their brain activity. And what we're looking at are what happens in the brain that changes that leads to this improved ability to do this task. What we're really interested in, how then does having better distraction and multitasking abilities translate to better memory? And that's the hypothesis of this experiment, is that if you're better able to ignore relevant information, you'll be better able to attend to things that are relevant to you. So that's what we're trying to show here. One other piece of the puzzle is that we recently formed this collaboration with the company NeuroFocus, and they're supplying us with Bluetooth dry electrode caps. So the subjects will go home, and while they play the game on the laptop at home, it will record brain activity and wirelessly send it to the laptop so we can look at what happens in the brain over the training periods in their own home. So I think that this is an exciting way to start using brain recordings to look at how we deal with interference in terms of distraction and multitasking. So I'd like to conclude there. Thank you for your attention. Of course, your lack of attention, other things. Thank members of my lab. So we have some time for questions.
Hi, thank you for this amazing presentation. Can you define older adults, the age range? Because, you know, you gave your experiment, and then there you know, charts and graphs, performance?
Yeah, it's a great question. I really glossed over that. I just did an aging talk here recently, and I tried to make this focused on younger adults. But in our experiments, older adults are 60 and older. And it's really an arbitrary level. As we know from a lot of behavioral studies, the brain really starts changing in terms of things like working memory and speed of processing from around 20, 23 on. So aging really begins around 20. So we don't think of aging anymore as a phenomenon that occurs to 60 and 70-year-olds. We think of it as a lifelong process of changing of brain and cognition. We tend to focus on the extremes in our experiments to pull out differences, but there's certainly some nice evidence coming along that are done in every decade of life, and you can see these changes occurring. But in the data that I showed you, they were 60 and older, 60 to like 80, 85.
And then those medicine that supposedly help?
Yes.
Do they have side effects?
They have pretty minimal side effects. So the cholinesterase inhibitors, what they do is they stop the breakdown of acetylcholine at the synapse, and they lead to increase in this very common neurotransmitter, which is basically one of the main neurotransmitters involved in attention. So it gives like your brain basically a little splash of attention abilities. But the cholinergic system also acts on the gut, so it can cause diarrhea and some vomiting, and some people have nausea, some people have very vivid dreams. There are millions of people that have taken it because it's one of the main treatments for Alzheimer's disease. And the side effects are fairly minimal. It's still questionable of how much of a benefit it has in young, healthy people. I actually did a study when I was at Berkeley with 30 college students, giving them a single dose of this or a placebo and looking at brain activity. And some people it seemed to help and some people it seemed to hurt. So it was really hard to tell exactly which way it sort of flushed out as a population that it had no effect.
Hi. Is there any anatomical evidence or fMRI evidence or MRI evidence that the multitasking brain looks any different from the non-multitasking brain?
It's a good question. I am not aware of any. There's now some really nice evidence showing, well, okay, I'll tell you things that are close to that. So there's now an accumulation of evidence that the actual structure of the brain, not the function of the brain, can change with certain activities. So there's a very famous study now on London cab drivers that show that the hippocampus, the part of their brain that's involved in memory and spatial navigation, is larger than non-cab drivers. Actually, they compare them to bus drivers, which really follow a set route and don't have to know the city quite as well in a dynamic way. And then there's another interesting study that showed that people that learn how to juggle actually have changes in parts of the brain involved in motor control, and musicians too. So I don't know of any, although I'm sure one will come out soon, of any study really directed at multitasking. The question was, would the prefrontal cortex be bigger? The studies that studied by Ducks that just came out in 2009 showed, and a lot of studies that show that with practice on something like multitasking, what you actually see is a decrease in activity in prefrontal cortex, not an increase, which has been attributed to the area becoming more efficient. So it was at first we all sort of intuitively thought that these areas would show more activity. And now we see with practice things actually decrease as a sign of efficiency.
What about, is there an increase in distraction since there was before, like caffeine? I feel like we're an over-caffeinated society, and we're with kids or adults.
Yeah, I have not read about the interaction of caffeine with distraction, but I think that it does increase sensitivity to stimuli, so I can imagine that it might have, and there might be data on that. I'm not sure.
I was noticing your study of the young people, the one-year-olds and three-year-olds, and their attention capabilities at seven. Mm-hmm. And I have raised a couple of kids, and it seems to me that 75% of their peers, starting at about 11 on to 17 or 18, are taking ADD or ADHD meds. And I'm just wondering, is there enough evidence to prove that all that time that they were parked in front of televisions from 1 until 5 or 1 until 7 is...
I mean, so first, that wasn't my study, but I do think it's an interesting one. It was published in the Journal of Pediatrics and really helped change how the pediatric society advises television watching. I think that the interpretation of that data is that There are many factors that contribute to ADHD, and genetics has been shown to be one component, but that environment is probably another strong component. I mean, it's always fair to say that both environment and genes are going to be involved in most things. And I think at least that's the interpretations that I read. And so the authors, I know, feel pretty strongly, at least from reading some of this debate in the literature, that they would say that they would think that that might very well be the case, that those were the people that were sitting in front of a TV at these very formative years of 1 and 3. Whether or not that's true, you know, it's just a speculation based on the data.
Okay. Well, what came to mind first when you first put the slide on the board was that scene in HAL where the computer takes over and my stomach tightened up. And anyway, my mother had 7 kids, and I was the oldest. And so I always think it's interesting to think in terms of multitasking, because when you're taking care of 6 kids at once, you have to be able to multitask. And anyhow, and the other thing that came into mind, because this is all seems to me about mechanical things, it's, when I first went into the Yale library in back in the 60s, and it was all still a card catalog, and I swear the card catalog of the Yale library might have been a block square. And right then, I mean, the idea of the overwhelming of the amount of knowledge that was out there that would I would never even get a toehold on. Mm-hmm. And I think that's the problem, is that now it's all right in front of us, as opposed to back then it was in a library and you could forget it was there.
Yeah, I think that it's a really complicated issue. I mean, a lot of technology has clearly evolved, especially over the last decade, to allow us to deal with the tremendous amount of information that exists more effectively. I think a lot of it is driven towards that goal, even things like Google, to be able to have such a rapid search of a large information base. And I think that you get an interesting phenomena when technology evolves, unexpected side effects occur. And I think that the multitasking of all this media that was probably, that seems to have evolved, at least intuitively, to deal with a large information load might have some negative consequences too. And I think, you know, there are many examples over history of technology having sort of unforeseen negative consequences that emerged out of these really positive goals. So I think that might be related.
So from a demographic or psychographic profile, can you compare people with a tendency to multitask with people who aren't? Are they older, more intelligent, more educated, or what?
I haven't read all that much about the demographics. It's younger people more than older people. That seems to be clear. Most of the reports that I read were focused on children and multitasking. So the Kaiser Family Foundation just did these two massive reports, one on media and one on media multitasking, that they realized was an issue only after they did the first report. They were amazed. I mean, so kids were using media around 6 hours a day and around 8.5 if you counted in all the multitasking. And I have not read any full reports that compare the demographics across the age groups.
Income, education?
I don't know. I would imagine that given that a lot of this media is expensive, that it would probably be related to, you know, higher economic means to be able to have an iPhone and, you know, a laptop on your lap and this type of thing. So I would imagine that would be the case, but I haven't read any data on that.
I want to go back to little kids for a minute.
Mm-hmm.
My son's now 30, but when he was a little one, I remember being told there was a big difference between watching Sesame Street and Mr. Rogers, primarily that Sesame Street was calibrated to a certain length attention span, and Mr. Rogers, of course, you know, held the kid for the whole whatever mm-hmm. length the show was. So, you know, we were advised at that time to do both,
right,
not just one or the other. The thing I wanted to ask you, though, was that I have, I'm wondering if you have looked at any of the studies on meditation and that impact on strengthening the executive function of the prefrontal cortex.
Yeah, we have not done that work in our lab, although we're interested in it. So I guess the two-part question was the type of media. This paper that I cited, and again, this is not my area of research, so I only read several papers on it, but they didn't compare between different types of media, but they seem to make the very strong case that they don't really care what the type of media is, that they feel like this type of two-dimensional presentation is not have the same developmental benefit as the sort of three-dimensional type of interactions that exist in real-world type of play for a child. But I haven't seen a comparison of different types of media. And in terms of meditation, there is a growing body of evidence. So I actually gave you sort of a one-sided account there because that's the study that we're doing in terms of that active training. There's really two sides to the training issue, sort of like the Eastern and the Western view of it. And one is that you can train through high-intensive practice and repetitive engagement in a task will lead to more efficient processing in your brain. I guess that's sort of the route that we're adopted here. And then there's another route that by learning how to control your ability to take in certain information and do certain types of processing at will through like things like meditation, that this also helps attention. And there's definitely a growing literature on that too. There's a couple of interesting review articles out there that compare these two types of training.
In your slides, you were talking about comparing a distracted environment versus not. Have you done any maybe more depth in terms of like the number of distractions? Like, is there an optimal number? For example, someone who uses Twitter and Facebook and Gmail all at the same time, have you found like performance increases exponentially worse with more distractions?
Yeah, I mean, that slide that I showed you was sort of looking at the number of distractors, and they were seeing like once they started getting 4 or 5, that's when the multitasker started declining. That's the only study that I've ever seen that looked at the number of distractions. Like maybe you could say, okay, if I just do, you know, Twitter and I'm and working on this document and the radio's playing, that's sort of where I'm okay. But throw in like texting and I'm just over the limit. Like I haven't seen that. I'm sure it's probably true. And I think that it's probably very individually dependent. So one thing we see a lot is that there's individual variability. Some people really can deal with a lot more than others. But we know that everyone is capable of being of having their resources exceeded. So where that is sort of you know, something that would have to be shown case by case. All right, thank you so much.
Our thanks to Dr. Adam Ghazali for his presentation here today. We also thank our audiences here as well as those listening to the recording. And now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California commemorating its 106th year of enlightened discussion is adjourned.